This is our second virtual class in the writings of Yitz Greenberg, the third great cycle of Jewish history. Of course, the framework is Providence and Theodicy, post-Holocaust thinker. So let's review a little bit what we did last time and the time before. And you have in front of you my notes to review this. So let's just read what I wrote, and then we can immediately go on, everyone being on the same page. The Nazis tried to show that Jewish life is worthless. It wasn't just a matter of killing and annihilating Jews. It was cheapening, in a theological sense, cheapening human life, specifically cheapening Jewish life. They made a frontal assault on Judaism, and not just on Jews. And from the point of view of Yitz Greenberg as a theologian, the assault on Judaism and on Jews is to be understood as an assault on God, an attempt to kill God, as it were. Because from a Jewish point of view, God is known to the world through the Jewish people. That's the purpose of the covenant. The whole purpose of the covenant is that the world will be blessed through the Jewish people, which means bringing the knowledge of God to the world. An assault on the Jewish people that says there should no longer be Jewish people is an assault on God, on God's presence in the world. The Nazi movement was testimony that there is no God, that God is irrelevant to human life. And had the Nazis succeeded, it would be as if they had killed God. But they didn't succeed. The Jewish people are alive, which means that God is alive on earth, because we're here. Number two, on my sheet, I began with the other hand. At the same time that...
We're not getting sound.
You're not getting sound.
Now we are.
Okay. At the same time that Nazism was an assault on God, an almost successful assault on God, just a few years later, the birth of the State of Israel is a redemptive act of historical magnitude, says Rav Yitz. These two events are dialectically opposed to each other, profoundly linked. Right, as if to say that within 5 or 6 years, there was absolute testimony that God is almost dead, and at the same time, just a few years later, there was absolute testimony that God, that God's plan is alive. Okay? You can hear me? Great.
Fading in and out. Well, we sort of, you're fading in and out.
Is our picture coming through?
The picture is fine.
Okay. I will wave my hand like this when for some reason we're not getting sound.
Great idea. And then I'll stop talking.
Sound every once in a while fades.
I hear. That's disappointing. The third era in Jewish history, what Rav Yitz calls the third era, continues the trajectory it began in the second era, meaning that God's presence becomes more and more hidden. I'm paraphrasing what I wrote for you on the sheet in front of you. God's withdrawal from history, from human life, according to Rav Yitz Greenberg, is a call to human beings to take up the slack and to exhibit greater covenantal responsibility. It's good? Okay. Now, remember, in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple, God's presence is concentrated in the temple, which means there's a little bit less presence every place else. Rav Yitz says when the temple is destroyed, so there is no particular realm of the holy anymore. God's presence is hidden in other places. In other words, when there's no particular holy realm, every realm becomes potentially holy. In our day, not only was the temple destroyed, but the Nazis took God, as it were, out of the public realm. They took God out of anywhere. They tried to kill God. God is completely hidden now. There's no particular place that God is. And therefore, God is potentially everywhere. Rav Yitz wants to say that just as the temple was lost 2,000 years ago, and the divine presence became available in all places, in our day, even the synagogue is losing its particular holiness, which goes to tell us that holiness is to be potentially found everywhere. No temple, and today not even a synagogue that's particularly holy. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Since there's no temple, and there's no particular place where God is found, rather God is found everywhere, but not overtly, hiddenly, therefore the realm of religious activity today is no longer the temple, no longer the synagogue, but everywhere. Religious activity has to be everywhere. But the nature of religious activity changes. Everything we do that affirms life, everything that affirms Jewish identity, everything that affirms the state of Israel, for Rav Yitz now becomes holy. Visiting Israel is holy. Giving money to Israel is holy. Joining a federation board is holy. Even identifying yourself as a Jew when someone asks you, it's holy. All those are not religious acts. Because those are acts that are counter-testimony to the Nazis. The Nazis said that no more Jews and therefore no more God. Anyone today who decides to be a Jew, and everyone who's a Jew today is volunteering, it doesn't have to be, you can hide the Judaism and no one will know. No one's forcing you to proclaim it. If you today decide to continue identifying as a Jew, that's a holy act. That's act of affirming the Jewish people, which is an act there of affirming God. That it's all holy. Susan Kramer is the chief rabbi of Dallas. You last 3 seconds late. I don't know why. No. No.
Is Rabbi Greenberg at this stage confining himself to the Jews, or if God is everywhere, God has to be, he's in every space?
Good point. For Rav Yitz,
when Yitz says filling secular space, he means everything. So this room is just as sacred as a sanctuary of the synagogue. Or can be.
Yes, that's what he's saying. And that's... Is the sound back? So that's what he's saying. There's no particular place that is holy. Every place is potentially holy. And the way we actualize that holiness is by proclaiming God. How do we proclaim God? Just by being Jewish, we're proclaiming God. Because that's the purpose of the Jewish people. And today, like I said just 2 minutes ago, you could ignore your Judaism, you can hide it, and no one will force you otherwise. If you decide to identify as a Jew, that's a holy act. And you get a lot of credit for that. Not only is it a holy act, it's a dangerous act. We all know that in post-Holocaust world, it's dangerous to be a Jew. Anyone, says Rav Yitz, that identifies as a Jew, he deserves a gold star. Doesn't matter, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, or secular. Just proclaiming that you're a Jew, that is risking your life with Judaism as Kiddush Hashem. That's sanctifying God's name. It's risking your life for God, whether you define it as that or not. That's what it is, says Rav Yitz. And again, you deserve a gold star for that, he says. And that's, of course, part of Rav Yitz's belief that... It doesn't matter how you identify yourself, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, liberal, or secular. If you call yourself a Jew, that's a big, 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 big thing, says Rav Yitz. Yes?
We're talking about in the second era, according to you, God was focused in the temple?
Well, in the first era.
Oh, in the first era. Okay. But what about the concept of God being omniscient? Did that not exist back then? Or, you know, the implication, although the words are a little bit different, is that God has become from focused in a temple environment to a broader environment, which may be more like being omniscient than before.
Good point. The idea of God's omniscience, of course, is a... is a interpretation of medieval Jewish philosophy. You don't necessarily have to get the impression from the Tanakh that God is omniscient. In the book of Leviticus, God is in the sanctuary. In the book of Deuteronomy, God is in heaven. In the book of Deuteronomy, it says that God walks in the presence of your camp. But the reference there is to the army camp that's going out to conquer the land of Israel. It might be that that means to say God is there, but not other places. There's certainly other books of the Bible which you could, from them, get an impression that God is all over. The book of Isaiah says that the heavens cannot contain me. Perhaps it gives the impression that God also spills over onto the earth. I don't know. But philosophical thinking that God is in every place, that's from the Middle Ages.
Okay.
Rav Yitz says that after the Holocaust, it's time to do God and not to talk about God. For two reasons we shouldn't talk about God after the Holocaust, says Rav Yitz. One is because it's shameful, it's embarrassing to say anything about God when God allowed children to burn in open pits. I personally tell you, when people talk to me about God's providence in helping the Dallas Cowboys to win a game, or to for them to pass a test, or that their home wasn't flooded when a pipe broke, to me that's sacrilegious. And it's especially sacrilegious in the presence of burning children. You can't tell me that God is concerned with Dallas Cowboys when he wasn't concerned in the same way to save those burning children. So just shut up, says Rav Yitz, and I don't use that phrase lightly. Shut up and talk less about God. That's point number one. Point number two is that the Nazis did what they did in God's name. They understood themselves to be good Christians. And, says Rav Yitz, they so sullied God's name, I don't want to use that same name of God as long as their memory is alive. Because the God that they believed in, I don't want to have anything to do with that God. Mo.
Why do you continue to use the word Nazis rather than Germans?
I'm just using the word that Rav Yitz uses. As far as I remember, I don't remember him using the word Germans. He uses the phrase Nazis. I'm just trying to be faithful to what I read there.
I've always thought that if you use the word Nazis, that excuses the Germans from what they did, because it sounds like the Nazis were some people who came down from space and did what they did and left.
Right, I hear what you're saying. That's not my intention. That's certainly not my intention.
There's an irony here in what he's saying, because the memory of the murders, because the murders have hijacked God's name, and it is almost sacrilegious to speak that name until the memory of the murders is erased. Yet we're doing everything right now to make sure that the memory of those murders stays alive.
I hear what you're saying.
Every Holocaust museum and university courses, we want to make sure that we never forget that.
I hear. I don't know what to answer to that. But what you're saying is obviously true.
It also implies, if what he's saying is, that we shouldn't refer to God because the Nazis have obliterated the existence of God. Well, that's inconsistent, I think. I mean, how can we allow them to tell us by their actions that we shouldn't refer to God?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. There's just, Rav Yitz has a very visceral sense of just being ashamed to be a religious person after seeing what religion did. And therefore, let's not talk about religion. Let's, by our actions, show religion to be something other than what the Nazis showed it to be. And again, Rav Yitz says, don't talk about it, but do something about it. What does do something about it mean? So he said it means the very fact you identify as a Jew, that's a big thing. Secondly, any act that is counter-testimony to the Nazi testimony that life is worthless, any act that shows life to be precious, that's Judaism. Work for social justice. Work to save life. Work to save conflict, to prevent conflict around the world. All that is Judaism. And all that is holy. All that is counter-testimony to the Nazis. And that's what's important in our day, says Rav Yitz. Number three, he also says, Dorothy.
I understand this is his philosophy, but taking God out of religion seems to be I don't know what the right word is.
Secularization.
You know, it becomes a secular activity rather than a people's activity following a faith.
That's a good point. I understand. He doesn't mean to take God out of it. He means the way you bring God into it is not with your words, but with your deeds. Let's go to the soup kitchen and say, this is what God wants of me. But don't sit at the JCC in a philosophy class and talk about God.
And just talk about God.
Thank you, Mo. You've redeemed me. Yes, let's go on now in my review. So, number one, we said that today we do Jewish, or we are Jewish, we affirm God by affirming our Jewish identity. Number two, by working for social justice and proving that the Nazis were wrong when they said life is meaningless. Number three, it's erasing all traces of prejudice and discrimination from Judaism and from Christianity. Now that's purifying religion to make it clear how much an enemy religion is of Nazism. We have to make it clear that all of the prejudice and all of the discrimination and all of the lack of respect for life in Nazism, we have nothing to do with that. We have full respect, utter respect for human life, Jewish and non-Jewish. That should be the stance of Jews, and the stance of Christians should be full respect of life, whether it's Christian life or non-Christian life. Religion has to become counter-testimony to the murder of the Holocaust. So now, is going on. Rav Yitz emphasizes that all the Jewish work we do, whether we call it secular religious, it's all religious. It's all about God. Serving in the Federation Board, that's really in the deepest sense about Jewish identity, therefore Jewish testimony that God is alive. Call it secular, but it's really religious. Giving money to Israel, it's religious. Visiting Israel, supporting Israel, AIPAC, it's all religious. That's what is Judaism in our day. All of these things. And now, at the very end of my summary, I have something there that we didn't get to last time. But let's read it. Let me tell you about it instead of reading it inside. We once saw a Talmudic passage. in this classroom, in the boardroom, that goes like this. It's in Tractate Shabbat. It says that when the Jews left Egypt and arrived at Mount Sinai, and God wanted to give them the Ten Commandments, that God held a barrel over their heads and said, if you accept the Torah, well and good. And if not, here will be your grave. In other words, God said, I'll drop this barrel on you if you don't accept the Torah. And of course, the Israelites accepted the Torah. That's what the Midrash says. And I explained when we learned this Talmudic passage that the Midrash is actually making a point that's right there in the simple text of the Torah, which is that the Israelites had no choice but to accept it. Because what could they do? They were dependent on God for everything. For their water, for their food, for their navigation, for their shelter. They're like little children. Whatever God says, they have to do. They have no power to do otherwise. So the metaphor of the barrel is really just in order to concretize what's really clear from the text, that they are coerced by God. So that means the Torah was accepted under coercion 3,000 years ago. And then the Talmud says the following short statement. Mikan moda'a rabba le'oraita. This is a strong objection to the Torah. This is a strong objection to the Torah, which means the following. That if you are right, if the Midrash is right that the Torah was accepted under duress, then it's not obligatory. Because it's like a contract that you signed when someone put a gun to your temple. Right? The contract is not legally binding. And then the Talmud says, it's okay, don't worry. The contract may not have been legally binding, but the Jewish people re-accepted it voluntarily in the time of Mordechai and Esther, as described in the book of Esther in the holiday of Purim. Why? Because in those days, the time of Mordechai and Esther, there was no barrel being held over their collective heads. There was no coercion, no duress. What does it really mean there was no barrel? It means there were no miracles, no overt miracles in the time of Mordechai and Esther. In the book of Esther, in the scroll of Esther, there is no mention of the name of God. It's all human beings. And if under those circumstances, where there's no temple, there's no miracles, there's no overt divine presence, the Jewish people affirm their connection to Judaism, then that is a reacceptance voluntarily of the Torah, says the Talmud. And that's why today the Torah is binding. Carol Ann.
Well, in the book of Joshua, they willingly accepted the covenant, did they not, once they crossed over into the land?
That's a good point. But then also you can say there were some miracles. The city of Jericho was conquered miraculously, the city of Ai. But in the time of Mordechai and Esther, when, as we know from what we've read with Rav Yitz, where at the beginning of the second stage in Jewish history, when there's less and less miracles, less and less divine presence. So under those circumstances, if the Jewish people continue to affirm their Judaism?
Keep trying to talk so I can tell when we're reestablished.
Are we reestablished? Are we reestablished?
Yes.
Are we reestablished? No sound.
Oh, no. It's very intermittent, so keep talking if you can.
I'm still talking.
Yeah.
I'm still talking. Okay. Thumbs up. Two hands up. Great. So that's what the Talmud says. Today we observe the Torah because in the time of Mordechai and Esther, the Jewish people took it upon themselves voluntarily, therefore the covenant is binding. Now listen to what Rav Yitz says. He says, look, it's true there were no miracles at the time of Mordechai and Esther, but the Jewish people they were saved, right? In the battle against Haman, The Jewish people were saved. You could say that the fact that they were saved, that was an external, how do you call it? That was an external reward that encouraged them to identify Jewishly, right? Like, the Jewish people were successful, everything was going well for them, so people identified as Jews, it was easy to be a Jew. But says Rav Yitzchak, in our time, you don't even have that incentive to be Jewish, because it was so terribly difficult to be a Jew. In the Holocaust, it was dangerous, it was life-threatening to be a Jew. And therefore, says Rav Yitzchak, listen to this is beautiful, to affirm Judaism during and after the Holocaust is a greater act of God affirmation than it was to affirm Judaism in the time of Mordechai and Esther. Do you hear that? To take upon ourselves Judaism when you can lose your life for it. Not only is there no miracles that are going to save you, there are not even American armies that are going to save you. You really could... Mo?
Yeah, but I think Yitz is talking about Jews and not Holocaust.
Say it again, please.
Saying that you are Jew today is an act of courage.
It's an act of courage.
But he holds that's true for every Jew, regardless of whether they're ultra-Orthodox or an atheist, right?
Right. Rav Yitz is saying that... Uh-oh, thumbs down.
No, in practical, yes.
Thumbs up.
By the definition, no. Because Judaism means we didn't want that.
Rav Yitz is saying... And,
I can't hear you.
Can't hear me.
We didn't intend for you to hear us.
Uh-huh. I can hear everything you're saying. Thumbs down. Thumbs up? Thumbs down. Thumbs up?
Yeah, we can hear you a little bit.
Okay. Thumbs up now. Thumbs down. Keep talking. Thumbs up. Thumbs up. Okay, you can hear me.
We didn't really hear your answer to his question.
Okay, so I didn't really answer it. Rav Yitz is indeed saying that anyone today who affirms his Jewish identity is doing a holy act, a courageous act of Kiddush Hashem, of sanctifying God's name, and it's on a higher level even than the Jews in the desert in the time of Moses, and even on a higher level than the Jews in the time of Mordechai and Esther? Because we're doing it when we know that it's life-threatening. That's big. That's it. That's the summary of last time. Joe?
Question. I'm having a little bit of a problem here where the concept that accepting and announcing that I am a Jew when it is going to risk my life, even maybe sacrifice my life, how is that so different than jihad? These terrorists that sacrifice their lives for their religion.
Well, if jihad means simply self-sacrifice, which is its basic idea, then you're right. It's the same thing. But in the news today, among terrorists, jihad is interpreted not just to mean sacrificing your own life, but taking so many other innocent lives with your life. That's what we're not doing.
But what about the sacredness of life and what I have always heard, 613 commandments, and I can break any of them in case of life and health other than three? Well, how does that come into play?
Because we believe that life is so sacred and life is so precious. Therefore, if any and of all of us are willing to risk our lives to affirm our Judaism, then that Judaism must be, in our minds, a absolute value. We're basically saying, just let me finish the sentence. Can you hear me?
Wait a second.
Maimonides
is against martyrdom. Martyrdom is not supposed to be a great virtue in Jewish life.
Let me just finish the sentence. Judaism proclaims life to be an ultimate value. But anyone who proclaims himself to be a Jew in the light of the Holocaust is risking his life. Which means that we are putting Judaism as a higher value than our life. So that's a statement of the ultimate value of Judaism. Why are we willing to make an ultimate statement of value about Judaism? Because Judaism means bearing witness to God. That's an amazing thing.
Is the act of speaking culture an act of an act of affirmation and the commandments about Shabbat, all the ritual commandments, all the Torah study? What is the role of all of that?
Of course. Every Jewish act is an act of bearing testimony to God. But Rav Yitz is just pointing out that the first of all those acts of bearing testimony is simply self-identification as a Jew. He doesn't want us to lose the point that that also is a great act of Judaism.
I think you're missing Joe's point. The jihadists commit suicide in order to, in the name of Allah, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's what they say. We're forbidden to commit suicide as Jews. It's the same as murder in Jewish idea. Am I right?
Yes, but it is true. But Rav Yitz says that we are all risking our lives by being in this room at the JCC. We are.
My intentions were not to go so far as suicide.
Right.
Now, jihad might include suicide, but I'm saying that maybe I shouldn't have used that as a comparison. But the point is that we're saying that we should risk our lives by admitting being a Jew in a context of we should be careful to save lives and not risk lives. There's a lot of the commandments in the Torah that says, you know, you should do this or do that in order to be sure that some life is not lost. So here we're saying, do something, and it's a very important something, and you are risking your life. So I gather that, as you said, Rabbi, that implies that Judaism, the existence of Judaism, actually does take a higher priority than individual life.
Yes, that's what I said, and that's what Rav Yitz is saying, but I actually can add something to that. This is not in the article, but it's consistent with other things I've heard Rav Yitz say, which is the following. Yes, the things we said are true. On an individual level, we are all risking our lives by identifying as Jews. We're risking our lives for Judaism, for God. And therefore, putting God and Judaism as a higher priority than our individual lives. That's true. However, says Rav Yitz would say, look at the larger picture. Why does God want you to be a Jew? Why does God want His name to be known in the world? So that God's values, in which He teaches the infinite value of human life, will be proclaimed in the world. And were it not for God's name being proclaimed in the world, were it not for the Jewish people, then humanity would never have learned about the sacredness and the preciousness of human life. What does it all mean, putting it together? That yes, I as an individual and Joe as an individual and Mo as an individual are potentially sacrificing our lives by proclaiming our Judaism. We're sacrificing our lives for God. But to sacrifice your life for God is ultimately because God is proclaiming the sacredness of human life. So you're giving your own life so that the idea of the sacredness of life will be known in the world so that future generations will be saved.
Every time I get up in the morning and get out of bed, I'm risking my life. So a lot of things that we do, we risk our life. I mean, in the truest sense of the word, by declaring you're Jewish, you're taking an extra risk.
Yes.
Not necessarily taking the only risk that could cause your life.
You're right, Dorothy. But everyone takes the risk of getting up in the morning. But only we add the extra risk of proclaiming that we're different from everyone else. We're Jewish.
And I accept that, but it's not the only risk that I take.
Granted.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
You have a risk, but not at this time. I don't see no risk. In this time and today, things are not that way. Maybe in the time of Esther and Mordechai or the Holocaust, but not today.
In this country, right?
In this country and in many countries, there are minority of countries that, yeah, even in Venezuela.
No.
You are Jewish and the president is in Cuba now, sick, but he acknowledged the Jewish community and offered protection for the acts that have been given. So this is not for today, I don't think, unless you are over there in Saudi Arabia or wherever.
Etty. I don't want to respond to Etty. Etty, I hear what you're saying. And of course, what Rav Yitz writes had more force in the 1950s than it does today, when the memory of the Holocaust was fresh. But still, anyone who studies a little bit of the history of 20th century Europe knows that the beginning of the 20th century was a time of great enlightenment, a time of hope, a time of democracy in Germany. But the Holocaust happened. And if it could happen in Germany, if it could happen in Germany, then it could happen today.
Well, the point is, like, we were in Germany last time 3 years ago, with the American Jewish Congress, we were told, in Berlin, do not wear a yarmulke, it's not safe. The same thing happens in Sweden now, they say, do not wear a yarmulke, it's not safe. And the same thing they say in France, it's not safe to wear a yarmulke now.
Right.
Obviously, you know, 3 years ago we were in Egypt, and I felt comfortable telling everybody that was in Tel Aviv. I would not tell them that now, it would be dangerous.
Right. So here in the United States, the Holocaust is not going to happen again tomorrow. And not the next day. Not in another year. But you can't be certain that it's not going to happen in another 30 years. You can't be certain if you learn your European history. And since you're not certain that there won't be another Holocaust in America in another 30 years, then if you raise your children Jewish, you're risking their lives. You're risking their lives.
That is a phenomenon that is not only Jewish. It's not only a Jewish phenomenon. Well, the Christians also had their persecutions at one time, for one reason or another, so they were risking their life by declaring they were Christians. Or in Africa, the Tutsis were against the Tutsis, you know, whatever, these tribes. It's just part of, unfortunately, of human societies or life.
But the persecution of Christians went on for 200 years, 250 years. It was a passing historical phenomena, and it came to an end. But the Holocaust wasn't a passing phenomena. It was the culmination of 2,000 years of persecution, and the conditions that brought forth the Holocaust have changed, but not completely, as Jim was just saying, that anti-Semitism is still there in the world.
Well, if you go to a communist country, all the religions are not permitted, and all the communist countries, you know, it used to be in Russia, not anymore.
Okay.
Not seen so well either in Cuba, and the places where, communism is practiced.
Okay, fine, but again, history tells us that looking at the world as a whole, the most dangerous identity to take upon yourself is the Jewish identity. And like it or not, we've all decided to take that identity upon ourselves. So we all get a gold star.
Okay.
We're risking our lives.
Yeah.
And those of our children. So we're going to go on now in the article on page 13.
Okay. Now we're skipping the rest of page 12.
Yeah, I summarized all that.
Okay.
And we're going on to page 13, where it says, from powerlessness to power, secularity applied. You ready?
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you like me to read, or would one of you like to read?
You read.
I read, okay. The most decisive change in the Jewish condition and in the shift of focus from the realm of the sacred to the realm of the secular is the move from powerlessness to power. The creation of Israel is an act of restoration and redemption and is the affirmation of the covenant through worldly effort. It is the key application of religion to actuality, and as such is the classic expression of hiddenness and the new holy secularity. In other words, who established the state of Israel? Human beings. Jewish human beings. It wasn't, at least in overt sense, it wasn't God's miracles, it was human action. The Jewish people have regained power, and that power is about a recalibration of the balance of the covenant. Covenant between man and God, the Jewish people and God. First cycle of Jewish history, God was the major partner, the Jewish people were a minor partner. In the third cycle of Jewish history, the Jewish people are the major partner. We do the heavy lifting. Which means we have to take upon ourselves the responsibility of now, we're accountable for our actions. In the ghetto of 60 years ago, and 100 years ago, and even 1,000 years ago, we Jews, on the level of politics, the level of the secular realm, the level of government economics, we couldn't do too much good, but we couldn't do too much bad. We had no power. All of our power was in the synagogue and in the Beit Midrash. It was all religious. It was all words. It was all our ritual. It was all prayer. It was all calling upon God to act. But in this time of Jewish history, we act. And that brings with it the burden of responsibility for acting properly. We never had that burden in the past. We didn't have the problem of acting economically responsibly, politically responsibly. Today we have that responsibility. Attaining sovereignty brought a major shift in the allocation of Jewish resources, energy, and spirit as it became necessary to create a society and build the infrastructure of power. Let me stop a second and say, what did Jews do 100 years ago? They put on tefillin. They learned Torah. They did mitzvot. They counted the Omer. They prayed to God. Today, and those were religious acts. Today, Jews do all those acts, but they do additional religious acts. We pay our taxes. We elect our officials. I'm talking about the state of Israel. We vote. We have power. So that means that today there's a whole new realm of Jewish religiosity that has opened up for us. Everything can, you give money to the state of Israel. You better make sure you give it to a good cause. What if you give it to a bad cause? That's misuse of your power, and that's a transgression. Now, today it's still a mitzvah to keep Shabbat and keep Kashrut, but there are additional mitzvot today, says Rav Yitz. And don't lose sight, those additional mitzvot are, in his words, religious. They're just as religious as the other mitzvot. The focus of religion has moved from praying to God to get things done to making sure ourselves that God, that we get things done. Okay, the bulk of the activity in society and state is secular by pre-Holocaust standards. In itself, this assures the relative centrality of secular activity in the Third Era. But this activity is also central to the defense of Jewish existence and therefore is life-affirming and gives religious testimony. Right? Serving in the IDF, that's a religious act. And I think we understand intuitively that today it's important to put on tefillin, but it's just as important to serve in the army. I'm talking if you're in Israel. And I just wanted to say something. Yes?
I'm losing something someplace, or maybe I'm not sure. But it seems like Yitz's position is an evolution to secular Judaism, in that he's saying, don't mention God in the context of the Holocaust, so you're not talking God. Now you're saying that your actions are holy actions, when those actions may have very well have been the same actions that a secular person would have done anyway.
You're right, Joe. You're right.
So, it's almost like it is diminishing Judaism or religion.
Joe, you're 100% right, except that Rav Yitz describes it differently. It's not diminishing Judaism, it's expanding Judaism. It's expanding Judaism.
Well, that just appears to be a matter of definition. It doesn't appear to be factual. You know, and that if you don't talk about God and you do good,
I lost you.
A person not even believing in God.
I lost. Yeah. Now you're back. Say the sentence again.
Am I back?
You're back.
Am I back yet? Okay. Then it sounds like it's just a matter of redefining the existence of secularism as being religious, having religious meaning. When, why wasn't that true before? Now all of a sudden, because we don't have a valid excuse for things like the Holocaust, we're now saying, oh, okay, then I'm going to just say everything that's secular is religious.
Well, I guess really the difference is related to Israel, and you're talking about building the Jewish society, and anything that goes towards building the Jewish society in Israel affirms the presence of God, the existence of God.
Yes. Let me, you're right. Carol Ann?
And it sounds like also he's equating these kind of values to what we would call Torah values.
Right. You're right. Before Mo speaks, I want to say something. Can I say a few words, Mo?
Yeah, please. Just 6 seconds. It's not just the society in Israel. It's building a Jewish society wherever you happen to live, in our case in the United States.
That's also true. It's less so, but it's also true. Mo is right. So let me point out that the thread of conversation that Joe just brought up is the same thread of conversation that we were in last week when Jay was leading the charge. Remember that? Jay was saying that this is all secular. What are you telling me? It's all, you're just using words meaninglessly. It's secular and you're calling it religious. So look, you're right and you're wrong. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I'm saying to Joe, you're right and you're wrong. You're right. The activities that in the past were called secular, we're now calling religious. But it's not arbitrary. Rather, it's that God has told us through the Holocaust that the focus of religious life is changing. Did you hear what I said?
Yes.
God has told us through the Holocaust that the focus of religious life is to change. Religious life, in the big sense, what is it about? According to Rav Yitz, religious life is about bringing knowledge of God's values to the world. What are God's values? God's values are the preciousness of human life. The value of human life, that's God's highest values. How did we bring that to the world 2,000 years ago? By studying about it and by praying about it. But over the course of 2,000 years, God has told us, I want you now to pray about it less and do more about it yourselves. Prayer means that human beings are asking God to do. But now God is asking human beings to do. It's the same values and it's the same covenant, but it's now our turn to feel upon ourselves the mantle of responsibility. If it's the same values and the same covenant, then it's the same religion. But it's our turn to be at the center of the religion. God says, I've done my part, I've trained you, I've readied you, now you do it.
How does God relate to the fact that the Jews have been expelled from the Muslim land after 2,500 years? You know, they were 2,500 years in Egypt, 2,500 years in Libya, 2,500 years in Baghdad, and they've been expelled. And Jews have no place in Arab lands anymore after 2,500 years. How does God explain that?
Ask him. But as you know, he's not answering. He's leaving the answers to us.
Now, the fact that before the state of Israel, before the state of Israel, our only concentration was just to be religiously Jews, because there was no state to serve in the army or to build the state or be a power militarily or economically. But now we can proclaim our Judaism by supporting the state of Israel. There is a Jewish state.
Right, indeed.
In Baghdad, in the 1920s, the first finance minister of the state of Iraq was Jewish. Jews were very active in the 30s in Egypt, as far as independence for Egypt. And they were very active throughout Europe, whether you saw in Czechoslovakia or Hungary or everywhere. They were very active in the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. They were very active in supporting the whole empire.
You know, not after the middle of the 19th century.
Yes, they were in 19, in the First World War, they were very much so.
So that's what Mo said, that it's not just in the state of Israel that Jews have power to express our values. We also have that power in the American government and in other governments. Look, let me just remind everyone, it's not just that the Jewish people have power we've never had, but all human beings today have power we never had. 1,000 years ago, to a large degree, human beings were helpless in the face of natural disaster, in the face of earthquakes, in the face of disease, etc., etc., etc. But as time has gone by, we have gained more power for ourselves, the human race in general. And the question is, are we going to use that power for good or for evil? Well, what's true for the human race is all the more so true. It's tenfold true for the Jewish people. We had less power than any other people for all of human history for the past 2,000 years, and now we suddenly have power in the Jewish state. And
how about Jewish power in the Communist Revolution? You look at the 20s in the Communist.
Are you saying that we've had power all along?
We did in the 20s.
Okay.
Positions. I'm not sure we had any power.
I understand.
I'm not sure.
But let's focus on the subject. So what it means is, yes, activities that we are used to thinking of as secular, Rav Yitz is telling us to redefine them as religious. Why should we redefine them as religious? Because God has redefined them as religious. By God retracting himself and giving more responsibility and power to us, he's telling us the realm of religion has expanded. Let me tell you something. A lot of people, or at least many people in the state of Israel, understand this intuitively. Let's talk about conversion, right? I'm changing the subject, but it's really the same subject. Here we are in America, you're in Dallas, I'm in your classroom right now, in America in the year 2012. What does it mean to convert to Judaism? Well, conversion is a religious thing, right? Conversion is religion. And whether you're Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, how do you convert to Judaism? By doing religious things, right? In the Reform movement, you have to learn some of the prayers, and you have to come to synagogue, and you have to learn Torah, and you have to learn how to chant the prayer service. And in the Conservative movement, the same thing. And in the Orthodox movement, basically the same thing. You have to learn the prayers, you have to learn about the mitzvot, you have to learn about all these religious things. In the state of Israel, today, the consciousness is basically developing among many rabbis that one of the prime things you have to do in Israel today to convert to Judaism is to serve in the army. And there's a whole movement within the halakha today in the state of Israel to say that a Russian immigrant who came to Israel, let's say 20 years ago with his parents, he under law of return because his grandfather was Jewish, but his mother's not Jewish, and his father's not Jewish, and he's not Jewish halakhically. And now that kid has grown up in the state of Israel, and he feels himself part of the Jewish people because he's here. And then he serves in the IDF for 3 years. And then he comes, he says, I want to be Jewish. Well, many rabbinic authorities are saying, you should be in, because you just converted to Judaism by risking your life for the Jewish people by serving the IDF. I'm not saying that's the major opinion on halakha today, but that's the developing trend. And that's exactly what Yitz is saying. That as the Jewish people enter the real world of power and politics and economics and the military world, what Judaism, which used to be limited to the religious realm, well, Judaism is all those realms. And if you take part in Jewish life in those realms, well, you've done something religious. To make aliyah is a religious act. To stir, serving the IDF is a religious act. To go to work in Israel 6 days a week and to take off on Shabbat, because that's the day that you don't get paid if you go to work, there is no work on Shabbat, well, that's a religious act also. Even though it's a secular act. Secularity has become the new religious, says Rav Yitz. And it's really true.
Well, how about serving the IDF?
Say it again?
How about the Druze serving the IDF?
That's the only reason why a Druze that serves in the IDF, the only reason why that's not an act of partial conversion to Judaism is because in the mind of the Druze soldier, it's not. It's a matter of how you understand it. He understands himself that he continues to be Druze. Right? But a Russian immigrant who sees himself as Jewish because he got a Jewish education in the state of Israel, and he goes to the IDF because that's what all his Jewish friends do. That is part and parcel of binding his faith to the Jewish people, no less than going to conversion program at Sheretz Israel and deciding to come to synagogue every Shabbat. You get the idea?
We seem to be having that same issue right here in the United States right now with respect to our Latino or Spanish American or whatever.
Conversos.
Folks that come to this country, they serve in our army, but they're not U.S. citizens. And so we're arguing that same issue here.
I understand. Yeah. And remember back to the joke I made an hour ago about Susan Kramer being the chief rabbi of Dallas. It's not only a joke. I understand she's not a rabbi. She's head of the Federation. But the Federation, says Ravitz, is not a secular organization. We have to redefine our terms. In a certain sense, she really is the chief rabbi of Dallas.
According to Rabbi Yitz, and our level of familiarity to somebody I've never met is kind of interesting, but according to him then, any good deed, good being defined as what we consider a mitzvah in Judaism, any good deed is a religious act. And
so, if you do it as a Jew, then it's a religious act. If you do it as a Jew, yeah, Mo.
Yeah, I think we're getting a little bit of confusion here. I don't believe that he's dismissing halakha.
Of course not. We're adding new halakhot. We're not dismissing old ones.
Yeah, I think that's his point, that we're adding new activities that were not considered religious, if you will, or testifying to God's presence, are now considered as part of proper Jewish behavior.
So instead of 613, we are approaching 700.
Yes. Yes.
We should still keep kosher. And we should still observe Shabbat. Those are still important.
We're having enough trouble with 613. Now 700.
But you should also give the Jewish world service.
Yes. Okay, so I think we're good. We're on the same page. Let's go back to the reading. We're at the bottom of page 13. Left-hand column, about 7 lines from the bottom. No, 10 lines from the bottom. The real power of the secular is that it combines natural and spiritual paths in an indissoluble way. Similarly, relating to and backing the state, means the state of Israel, become socially and theologically compelling activities, right? Compelling theologically, providing legitimacy and importance to fundraising, political activity, and other secular activities, while also giving great emotional and spiritual moment to prayer and the synagogue, right? Fundraising is now a religious activity. It's a secular activity that's becoming religious. Political activity, secular, but it's becoming theologically compelling. The secular organizations, however, have been frankly designed to serve this purpose, while the synagogue has been slower and more reluctant to respond, further tilting the balance in Jewish life towards the secular. In other words, Rav Yitz is saying the synagogue has to understand that fundraising is also, fundraising for Israel is now also religious activity now. So do it in the synagogue. And studying Israeli politics is now a religious act. So do it in the synagogue. The synagogue has to respond to the fact that the realm of Judaism is expanding. Or to put it in a different way, don't think of the JCC as a secular Jewish organization. It's another synagogue. Say it again?
They don't close on Shabbat.
So neither do I. I'm still Jewish.
Okay.
No, it's interesting. I just finished reading Rabbi Sachs's book on Parkinson's. And then he starts playing basketball, having dances, belonging to clubs, doing arts and crafts in a Jewish community center is a proof of the presence of God.
Right, because it's an affirmation of Jewish identity. Exactly. So that's Rev Jonathan Sachs, you said?
Yes.
Okay, he took it right from here. Top of page 13. As the state or the exercise of Jewish power elsewhere becomes central to Jewish life, the litmus test of the classic ideas increasingly becomes whether they work in real life and whether society can be shaped by them. In other words, Jewish thought leaves the Beit Midrash and enters the real world of politics. Does it work? Can we apply it? Jewish ethics, can we apply it? We apply it in the real world. Let's see if it works. In similar fashion, the ability to generate moral or responsible exercises of power and a sense of purpose and meaning in personal activity becomes critical to the state's ability to hold its own Jews and to attract others. Right? Proper government, Joe.
No, it's not. I was raising my hand to talk, not to say that we weren't coming through.
Talk.
Okay. It sounds to me like this is, to some extent, professing that Jews go out and do what a lot of the anti-Semites say, and that the Jews are trying to take over the world. Now, we may be going out there trying to exercise our power in order to have them do good, but it could very easily be interpreted as we're just trying to take over.
I'm not sure why you say that. Here we're just talking about the State of Israel. We're trying to exercise power in the State of Israel. And exercise it.
This is limited to the State of Israel that we're talking about here?
Yes, it is.
I misunderstood. I thought it was talking about Judaism in general.
He's talking about the State of Israel here.
Okay.
When he says the state, he means the State of Israel. Thus, every act of daily performance takes on transcendent meaning in completing the redemption of the Jewish people. Building the earthly Jerusalem becomes the basis for reestablishing the heavenly Jerusalem. In other words, again, proper governance in Israel is a religious act.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Sounds like Rabbi Cook.
It certainly does. It certainly does. As far as I know, Rav Yitz has not learned Rav Kook, but he's come to very similar conclusions. And since Carol Ann just made the point, let me continue Carol Ann's point. If you remember, I don't remember if we learned this in our Thursday morning class or some other class, Rav Kook explained to us that the secular pioneers of the 1890s and 1900s and 1910s and 1920s, 1930s, by building the land and making the desert bloom, they were doing a religious act. They call themselves secular. Rav Kook doesn't care they call themselves secular. Rav Kook says, I see it as a religious act. And just like Rav Kook was expanding the realm of religion to include what other people call the secular, Rav Yitz is doing the same thing. Rav Yitz and Rav Kook came to this conclusion from two different places. Rav Kook came to it from his study of Kabbalah and his experience in early 20th century Israel, whereas Rav Yitz comes to it through his Holocaust studies and through his experience in late 20th century America.
Why is it that we can take this position with respect to Israel and not Judaism as a whole? Let's go back to the top first sentence on the top right hand of 13. As the state or the exercise of Jewish power elsewhere becomes central to Jewish life, the litmus test of the classic ideas increasingly become whether they work in real life and whether a society can be shaped by them. Now, it's not really, I mean, why is, can that statement doesn't, to me, doesn't imply that we are limiting it to Israel. That sounds pretty universal.
You're right. He said the state or the exercise of Jewish power elsewhere. You're right. I didn't notice that statement. You're right. Now, just let's remember that the Jewish state...
What I think is wherever we live, we should try to reassure the Jewish life. And that's it. And that's the way I understand it. Not that we want to take over the world.
No,
we can't. We are very little people.
I understand what our intentions are. I'm talking about
how the rest
of the world would see what our
So we will establish a good society and we establish our, like we are doing here. We are respected because we have good institutions, we have good organizations overall, you know, have good families.
But let's just remember that an individual Jew who is a member of the Obama administration, for example, he has the opportunity and the responsibility to put his Jewish values into practice as an individual and to, again, to talk in general terms, to teach the world about the preciousness of human life. He's doing it as an individual Jew. But the state of Israel is the chance of the Jewish people as a collective to put those values into practice. And obviously it's much stronger, it's much more meaningful as a collective than as an individual. Let's go on to the next paragraph. The key to performance and ethical excellence will be the systematic reconciliation of Jewish covenantal ideas and historical memory to the contemporary lives and activities of the Jewish people. In other words, what it means is, can we put our ethical ideas into practice, contemporary lives? Do our values work? And the halakha is being tested today like never before in the state of Israel. Do these values work? How do you run a state according to Jewish values? It's a problem, it's a challenge, it's a great, great responsibility and opportunity.
He's very much a pragmatist in that regard.
Say it again?
He's very much a pragmatist in that regard.
Yes.
A pragmatist.
Yes. Again, Judaism is not as Judaism talks, but as Judaism does. Does it work? Since power is results-oriented, more pragmatic and even more amoral than ideas, the capacity of the tradition to supply power with values and direction will be tested to the limit. Purists will recoil and dream of a pure religious reality, or will offer a spiritual critique of the grubby Israeli reality. Right? People say, this is too dirty, this is just politics, we have to retreat to the Beit Midrash. No, says Rav Yitz. Yet the assumption of power is inescapable if Jewish existence is to continue. This secularity is a matter of life or death. And he'll explain what he means. Thus the Holocaust and Israel come together, compelling the assumption of full responsibility for Jewish fate through the everyday activities of the Jewish state and of the Jewish society. There's a steady flow of Jewish energy, wealth, and talent, as well as continuing reorganization of the community in Israel and abroad to deal with the exercise of power. Let me explain what he's saying. He's saying, look, the state of Israel, of course, is giving us an opportunity and forcing us to take power, use power, and therefore we have to use the responsibility, apply our values. But the Holocaust is also forcing us to take power. Why? Because the Holocaust taught us that if we don't have power, we are going to lose our lives. In that sense, both the Holocaust and the State of Israel are forcing us to take responsibility. Let's read on. The reasons for this are historically inescapable. The Holocaust made it overwhelmingly clear that Jewish powerlessness was no longer compatible with Jewish survival. That I have underlined in my text. The Nazis' extraordinary success was made possible by Jewish powerlessness. That's never again. Right? Never again, says Reb Yitz, is a mitzvah. If we believe in Jewish values and we believe the world needs them, and if we believe we have responsibility to put them into practice in the world, then we have responsibility to make sure that we survive. That it's a mitzvah to make sure we survive. And that means having power and an army. Jim?
But on the other hand, without the Jewish presence, 6 million Jews in the U.S., and the political power they have here is supporting Israel, Israel would not, it's questionable if Israel would survive or not.
So fine, so perhaps you say that
Israel needed the support of France.
So fine, so perhaps you'll say that part of the mitzvah of Jewish power is to have influence in Congress and to have Jewish congressmen and Jewish men and women in the State Department. Fine, if that's what it takes to ensure Jewish survival, then that's a mitzvah also.
You see that the support of the Jew, the State of Israel is due to the American Jewish is that was a big part, but all over the world where there are Jewish people, there is all everybody supporting Israel. Okay? South Africa, Europe, South America, plenty big supporters.
Okay, so it's all part of the same picture.
Huh?
It's all part of the same picture. Had the Jews ruled their own land, millions could have been saved. In the crunch, even decent countries like the United States of America failed to open their doors to Jewish refugees. It is no accident that the PLO continually attacks the law of return, which guarantees every Jew the automatic right to become a citizen of Israel. In other words, the law of return says any Jew who is in danger in the world, he has a home in Israel. Because one of the purposes of Israel is to ensure that Jews will not be killed any longer. That's of our essence. The right to unlimited immigration means more than recruitment of the population that Israel needs. At the present time, the immigration rate is insufficient for this purpose. Despite the continuing attack on the law as racist, the law of return is staunchly upheld by Israelis because it's the most sensitive indicator that Jews are masters in their own land. That they exist by right and not by sufferance or by tolerant goodwill. Before the Holocaust, Zionism was a mass movement only in countries of Jewish persecution and Western Jewry was neutral or negative towards it. Since the Holocaust, however, Jews have become overwhelmingly Zionist because they have learned their lesson that Jews around the world need a state of Israel. We need a haven for our survival. Because it could happen again. Let's end with the next 8 lines. Dig beneath the surface and you will discover that even Jews who prefer to live in the lands of the diaspora have learned the lesson of the Holocaust. Even if you believe that it won't happen here, you can never again say that it can't happen here. Only the Jews who reject the significance of the Holocaust and live as it never happened, such as Antoni Carter or all-out assimilationists, now deny this truism. Right? Jewish survival demands there be a state of Israel and a strong state of Israel. And therefore, everything to support the state of Israel is a mitzvah. Okay, so I guess we're going to end here. It's a good place to... Let's just read 12 more words, but this will end. Because these words are so strong. Jewish powerlessness is also immoral. It tempts anti-Semitism into evil behavior. And we'll go on from there. So I hope that many of you get to see and listen and learn from Rav Yitz on Shabbat. Give him my regards.
Okay.
I told him a few days ago that I won't be there. I apologized. So he knows that... I just said, can you hear me? You can't hear me. You can't hear me, so we're finished. That's it. Bye. Bye. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you. Bye. We enjoyed another wonderful